In this episode of Voices in Art, I sat down with conductor and performer Elijah Langell. We discussed some of the formative experiences he had early in his career, his time spent working with world-class conductors, and his current work conducting the New Bedford High School Orchestra, as well as the Christchurch Chamber Orchestra.
My name's Elijah Langell, and I'm a local musician here on the South Shore. I'm a musician and an educator. So what I do is I'm a conductor, conducting mostly classical music with violins and cellos and basses and stuff like that. I've dedicated my life to conducting, to music, so far of what my life has become. And I'm also a musician in and of itself. I'm an organist at Christ Church Parish in Plymouth, and I gig around as much as I can. My entire life has so far been broadening my musical horizons. So that's me.
Very cool.
In a nutshell.
So I talk with people of all different ages. How old are you?
So I just turned 26.
Oh, okay, cool.
So some people say that's young. I'm going through my quarter life crisis. So, yeah. You know.
I was reading through your bio. You've got quite a few accomplishments so far.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Whatever they are, it's so funny when you write up bios and all of those things, and everyone tries to, you can't say all your failures, and you can't say all the things that don't make you look quote unquote good, but I've been really, really fortunate to have people give me the time of day.
Yeah.
There's so many opportunities that I've had just by sending people an email, calling them, or showing up on their doorstep. I can think of Michael Ellis Ingram, who is the conductor at the Mecklenburg State Opera in Schwerin, Germany. And he was someone that I had friends who knew him and worked with him. He's from America, but now lives in Germany. And just reaching out to him in an email, and he was so gracious enough to say, "Well, come on, let's do some conducting. Let me show you what it's like, and what the big guns in an opera house in Germany." And just to have people give up their time and of their talent, and just to mentor me, I would not be even close to the opportunities that I've had so far without people just giving up their time. That's the only way that you can get anywhere in the arts, or I think in most places. I try to do that too, because if I wouldn't be where I am, then there's a lot of people that I work with who, you need to give back.
Yeah, and so that's all so cool. I was thinking about, that's such a huge part of it, is really having those mentors, but reaching out to them in the first place. It's funny, those people aren't going to reach out to you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They might. There might be some program where you can sign up or something like that. But it's crazy how far shooting an email can really go. You know what I mean?
Well, that's the thing. We all want someone to notice us.
Yeah.
I mean, I deeply, deeply want that. And you want to walk into a room or into a program and have someone say, "Hey, you have something to offer. You've got talent. You're going to be something someday," and give you a chance. But I have to realize that early on, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm not that special enough, or people just don't see you in that capacity, or that's just not how it works. So you have to market yourself, and know that you're going to have a lot of unanswered emails. A lot of people say, "Sorry, kid, I don't know," or just shut the door in your face. And you have to be okay with that disappointment, knowing that it doesn't hurt to try. I think about a dear friend, colleague, and someone I respect so much who unfortunately passed about a year ago, is John Oliver. He was the founder of the Tanglewood Festival Chorus.
Okay.
Who is the official chorus of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, who I have sung with for the past 4 years. And John, I remember as clear as day, I was driving to interview for the current organ job that I have at Christ Church, and he called me. And this is the, different than what we just talked about, but he called me on the phone. He just happened to retire, and I didn't think he even knew who I was. I was just one person in this whole chorus. And he said, "Elijah," and I almost "Oh, Mr. Oliver," my voice cracked, and I had to pull over. What does he want? And he called to just encourage me, to compliment my musicianship, and to really wish me well, and if there's anything he could do to let me know. And here's a man at the end of his life, end of his career, beautiful career working with people like Leonard Bernstein, the best conductors, people in the world. And he just wanted to encourage me. So I said, "Well, do you ever want to get coffee? Can I come over to your house for tea?" And that made a couple of meetings, where I would go and drive over to the Berkshires by Tanglewood. And just talk, and he would just give out his wisdom, give me pointers, and just encourage me. And so that being said, sometimes you have to fight all the time to find people who will help you, but there are gracious people.
Yeah. Once you've like unbury them, find them, turn over the right rock.
Yeah. Well, and just accept it. You know, I mean, it was two different. I was, when I first met him, I was 24 or 23. And he was, just about hitting his 80s. Mm-hmm. Two different worlds.
Yeah.
Two totally different lives.
You got to open yourself up.
Yeah. Have to open yourself up and have some coffee and listen to this get your own head out of your own side and, have some tea and listen to this wealth of knowledge and just be friendly and you make a friend.
Yeah.
John became a very close friend, a dear friend. And unfortunately, he passed, but I was so glad that I got to sing and perform at his funeral or his memorial service.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
with
amazing.
The Boston at Tanglewood.
That gave me the chills. That's awesome.
Yeah. it was really moving and it was a special way to say thank you to a friend, who at that point in time, I really needed encouragement.
Yeah.
Just someone to say, hey, you know what, you got it, kid.
Yeah.
And just that little bit, I was like, you know what, maybe I can do this.
And someone as important to you as that, too. That's just so cool.
Yeah, well, he gave me a chance to sing with the Boston Symphony. I auditioned with him. He cracked a joke in the beginning of the audition, and I felt suddenly, I cracked a joke, and he laughed at my joke. I said, okay, this is going, this is good. He offered me pointers, and he offered me another chance, too, to perform with this world-class group. So I get to sing at Carnegie Hall and Boston Symphony Hall and look under these world-renowned conductors. And it was because of that that I could say, you know what, I want to do this. I want to do this conducting thing, and then I get to see these world, and I have to pay for it. It's amazing. And be part of the music making.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Integral to it.
Oh, yeah.
That's so cool. That's amazing.
All
right, so then let's jump on. Yeah. So where did it all start for you? Like, when did you first start doing music in any capacity, and then how did it sort of start blossoming from there?
Yeah, so I grew up in Plymouth. My mom's a music teacher. She works for the Salvation Army, and she's their assistant music director. So she goes all over the state, and she created a program called the Music Mentoring Program, which gives underprivileged children and adults music lessons free of charge. My father is not very musical, but he's a pilot. He's a mechanic. He's a very hands-on person. So I have these two kind of sides to me. I love working on my tractor at home,
and on
old cars and stuff. Like, that's my favorite pastime. But I also am so integrated with music, and I grew up with music lessons with mom. And I fuse those worlds a lot of the time. I always say that if I'm ever a famous conductor, all my students will all be working under like a 67 Chevy, because it's the same thing. In my mind, there's so many times you look at a motor and you just got to figure out how to fix it, and you're not sure how to fix it, but you have to figure it out. It's the same thing with an orchestra. You have to figure out how to get from point A to point B, and you might not exactly know what to do, but you have to figure it out. So you try different things, you whack it with a hammer, you see what happens. Going back to your question, growing up in Plymouth, my mom, as young as I can remember, got me teaching. There was always someone younger than me that needed a trumpet lesson or a voice lesson or a piano lesson. And she said, all right, Elijah, you do it. And these are people in need. I remember my first drum students was 87-year-old man.
Oh, wow.
Who was in part of, the Salvation Army in Plymouth, and he wanted to learn drums. And I was like, okay, I'll teach you. And he came faithfully every week.
How old were you at the time?
I must have been in middle school. I'm in seventh grade. So
it's like 12.
Yes, like 12.
That's awesome.
That's and to
so
me,
cool.
It was just something. It was so normal because that's just what you did. But looking back at it, it was like, well, that doesn't normally happen. So it gave me a confidence and just a ease of communication with students and stuff. That's helped me out so much. That's why for my undergraduate, I chose to go into music education, because although I love to perform and I so desperately want to become a famous conductor someday, education, it's all part of it. If you're going to perform, if you're going to be part of the arts, you're going to teach. Also, teaching has allowed me to have a vocation that not only pays my bills, but allows me to do what I love to do during the day, and then late at night, do orchestra rehearsals. So growing
up, really cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So growing up in Plymouth, lots of music. I played and grew up in the Salvation Army, so I played the trumpet or the cornet. And if you see those red kettles, where they ring the bell, that was me for a lot of my life, playing my little trumpet, playing Christmas songs for people to come collect money.
Like around Plymouth?
Yeah, yeah, around Plymouth. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a lot of late nights cold, just trying to play and, you know, and supporting the mission that the Salvation Army has. But that was a really early on knowing that the power of music to affect people.
Yeah.
Then I graduated from Plymouth North High School, the old building, you know, the one where the raccoon fell through the ceiling and all
that. Oh, wow.
That was, I think that was my class. And I went to Gordon College, which is a small liberal arts Christian school that for me at the time was perfect.
Oh, that's great.
It, albeit expensive, gave me the one-on-one attention that I needed, and it really transformed my mind. I had mentors in my life and that right there that wanted to invest in me. And I still go back and I talk to Dr. Rocks and some of these other teachers, Sandra Dineski, who just are always, you know, they're always open to help. I remember one of my first conducting teachers was Dr. Walter Pavasaris, and he was at Gordon at the time conducting. And I said, look, I want to be a conductor. I don't know where to start because I, you know, was doing all this ed stuff. I knew how to teach music. I knew how to, you know, do all the curriculum and all that, but I didn't know how to conduct or look at a big score. And I said, I don't have a lot of money, but I'll pay you. You know, whatever I can do, once a week, fine. And he looked at me and said, okay, once a week, one cup of coffee per lesson. So I said, deal. You know, yes, that was cheap, you know. So every lesson I would show up. It was before orchestra rehearsal that I played in, and I would bring him a cup of black coffee, and he'd drink it, and he would, you know, pour over the scores and just show me his thought process with things. And even just those little things were so huge for me. You know, who does that? I mean, not a lot of people do, you know, and in the same way, I've had other conductors that have, you know, gotten enough confidence to come and speak to him. It's like, would you please just, you know, one lesson or just show me what you're, and they said, sorry, kid, you know, see you later. But.
Like, I got stuff.
Yeah, I got stuff too, yeah. But there's something to be said where, you know what, yeah, they look at the mentor, the real kindness in people, the mentorship of a person to look at you and say, you know, all right, yeah, sure, and you can pay me, you know, how about one cup of coffee? So it's, that was huge. Classical music-wise, I actually wasn't very familiar with classical music or orchestral classical music up until college, and I played in the symphony orchestra, and I remember playing Sibelius's second symphony with Maestro Bruce Hagen. And he currently conducts at Boston Conservatory. I'm a wonderful conductor, and I remember that really being a pivotal moment, watching and listening to this symphony and seeing how he crafted it and how the musicians around him added their own inflections and how it all worked together. I said, I think this is it. This is what I want to do. And it's funny how one moment can change your whole entire life.
Yeah, set you on a path.
Yeah. If I wasn't there, if I didn't have the guts to try to audition for orchestra that year or whatever, I don't know what could have happened. Maybe this, but no, that moment I said, no, I have to do that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean I'm the best in the world. I'm not even, or even that good, but it's, you know, you get addicted to it in some ways.
That's so great. So do you compose as well, or are you really more into the conducting?
You only have so much, so many pieces of the pie, right?
Yeah, totally.
I have some friends who are really great composers. I'm not a huge composing person. My mom is a huge composer. She's a singer-songwriter on the South Shore as well. And she's even going to, she does a lot of composing right now, and she'll come in and say, oh, well, you know, what do you think about this? And play something on the piano and pick my brain about it. She is an amazing composer.
That's cool.
You've
got to focus.
Yeah, I have got to focus. Yeah. Well, even right now, I've, you know, being the organist at Christ Church, I didn't play the organ at all, or I wasn't even that much of a pianist in college, but it was the same thing. David Fredrickson at Christ Church, you know, he gave me a shot because I fell in love with the instrument in college, later on in college, and I said, you know what, I really want to do this. I would practice like crazy, you know, with a cup of coffee late in the night and just keep going. Hopefully Gordon doesn't get mad at me at this, but I would, you know, I was a custodian. That's how I paid my way through school. Well, you know, I still accrued massive amounts of debt, but, you know, I would be all night I would have to clean all these bathrooms and everything, but I would sneak into the chapel and wheel out the organ, you know, because I had all the keys.
No one was going to know.
Yeah. And I would just play the organ for hours, wheel it back, you know, and then go to work.
That's awesome.
But then to have an opportunity here in Plymouth to be an organist and to really hone my craft and to, you know, and I'm taking lessons and to get better and better, I mean, that's exciting to me.
Yeah.
The cool thing about the organ and about a sacred setting like an Episcopal church is that, you know, what you do is immediately recognized by the congregation or the people coming to listen to you. You know, they're listening for a very sacred, really beautiful purpose. And there, some people are coming with trying to find solace. Some people are coming, you know, exuberantly. Something amazing happened. They had a new birth in their family and they're so happy and they want to come to church. And I get the opportunity to play and have people really listen.
Right.
And be and experience it and react mm-hmm. to music.
Be emotionally connected.
Yeah, yeah. And that, I mean, that's such an awesome feeling.
I bet.
Because a lot of times you play music and no one cares.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I feel for the musician, you know, you can go down in Plymouth at most restaurants and, you know, they're just background music.
Yeah.
And they're pouring their heart out playing beautiful stuff. And it's, you know, to get a captive audience is very hard.
Yeah. But no, that's really cool. That's a great point. I never would have considered that. Yeah, that's awesome.
It's one of my favorite jobs. And the cool thing is you know, I'll make a mistake and they don't care and they'll say, you know, hey, you know, thank you for playing. And they'll thank you for listening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool. I've tried to make that more about in my classical conducting as well, because, you know, there's a whole idea of perfection and we can really strive for that. We can work hard to do everything right. But if we're not communicating, me and the orchestra or the orchestra with the people listening, mm-hmm. then we've lost it.
Yeah. And also, what's perfection too? Because there's a level of interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You've got to interpret the mm-hmm. score. You've got to interpret the piece. And there are those moments where it's like, that's why some orchestras do better than others when they're both playing perfectly. It's like, no, those people are putting more into it. You know what I mean? I really love that when, like, I mean, my uncle's always showing me tons of different, like, recordings and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll hear different. Total huge differences. Will be like, oh no, never listen to that orchestra doing that performance. It's total junk.
Yeah.
You've got to check this one out. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
It can make a huge difference.
Well,
know?
That's the thing. I mean, Bernstein, when he was conducting, would do all of his recordings and people ripped him apart. I mean, he had some really mean people criticizing him. But he would do it the way he wanted to do it. He would take things faster, slower. Mm. He would just bend these phrases. And it had never been done. It was always a very strict pattern with some of these pieces. You know, classical music is something. It's funny. You know, playing the organ in a big stone church and conducting classical music, I'm really stuck in one age demographic. It's really me and a bunch of people with white hair or older people.
Yeah. You're probably usually the youngest guy in the room.
Usually. You know, but there is an exception. You do work with a lot of young, talented people, or just people who are excited about it. But I fell in love with classical music, and I'm a fan of all types of music, but I fell in love with classical music because I get to experience it. And I really believe that almost everybody can relate to classical music or a piece to classical music. A lot of times with my students, I tell them, it's okay to not like this piece by Mozart. It's really fine. You know, it's like, do you like all the music that's out right now? Yeah. But try it. Try something new. And you might find something that you love. And a lot of times people do.
Yeah. And there's a lot out there. I mean, you can find, like, century to century, it really changes.
You know
what I mean? Like, there's some Beethoven that I really, really love. For me, I listen to, contemporary classical. I listen to a lot of, like, mid-century classical.
Yeah.
I love Schoenberg and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like,
ooh.
I listen to some weird stuff.
Crunchy. Yeah,
exactly. But, I love tons of different music, but yeah, I totally get what you're saying. There's some stuff where it's like, no, I'm not connecting with this.
Yeah,
and that's how music works,
right?
And
that's okay. Yeah. But we have the culture of making people feel bad about that.
Actual being performers and stuff like
that. Yeah, yeah, and students or people, you know. And that's why a lot of people don't experience classical music, because they feel like they have to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they feel bad if they don't understand it, and they feel bad if they don't like it, and they act like, oh no, I can't tell anybody because I'm supposed to like it.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Find what you enjoy doing and just do it and enjoy it. You know, get all the stuffiness out. It's not worth it.
Yeah, that's really cool. So you've answered, like, so many of my questions. This is great. So what about, like, As a conductor, maybe as a teacher and stuff like that, what's like some one of your proudest moments looking back across your career?
Proudest moments. It's funny, it's a lot of times your proudest moments, you don't realize they're going to be your proudest moments until later on and until you think back about it. I'm very fortunate to teach at New Bedford High School, starting their orchestra program there. This is my fifth year teaching there. And when I started at New Bedford, you know, it was a school going through a lot of transition. It was recently brought to level four status, which is one step before state takeover. Mm. And New Bedford is a beautifully diverse, vibrant community, but had a lot of issues. So being a new teacher and going in there, it was really hard. And there were some really hard moments, and there were, frankly, some really, really hard students. Mm-hmm. I remember specifically, especially a couple of graduating seniors last year, I remember one student wrote me a letter, and they said, "When I first met you, I didn't think that you were legit. I thought that your blithesome demeanor and just how you care about everybody and how you respect everybody, I thought it was just a front, just to try to, you know, win us over, but you didn't really care about us." And then later on writing, she wrote, you know, "But how wrong I was, that you, even on your worst days, because once a student gets to know you after 4 years, they know when you've had a really bad week, but you're just trying to put on a front, but in a positive
make
way.
It through the day.
Yeah, and they can recognize, wow, he's going through some really hard stuff right now, but he's putting that aside to care about us. And it's probably a little vain of me, but just to be able to be seen by a student to have them recognize that, and also to genuinely trying to love and respect other people, even when they're not getting that back. I done my job, and I'm a music teacher. It doesn't matter if they didn't play, you know, all the piano stuff right or whatever I was teaching them. But you know, this student, also very musically successful, got the real lesson, which was, I was just talking to Dr. Rox at Gordon, and he said, so one time someone asked him, what do you teach? And instead of saying music, he said, children. I teach children. And I think that sums it up. It was beautiful to see that. And there's so many other stories I could talk about.
That's a good one, though.
Yeah, well, I got
that's a good one.
No, but I could talk about singing Mahler 8, you know, for the first time with the Boston Symphony. I could talk about all these other things, which were all great experiences. But that's humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what I want to keep, no matter what I do. Whether if, you know, I always say, well, some watch out, you know, Keith Lockhart, here I come. Or, you know, the Vienna Phil, someday I'll be conducting them, or all around the world. I want that, what Gianni saw. And I want that all the time. Mm-hmm. And I want the musicians that perform with me, or the audience that experiences the concert with me, to know that. Mm-hmm. And I want to truly exhibit that too.
It sounds like you're on track to becoming one of the people that you reached out to when you were just starting. And that's like so cool. Isn't that so?
I didn't think about it that way. I just hope I can actually help people.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
you know,
sounds like you're already doing that. Yeah. Honestly, that's like so cool.
Thank you.
That was a great story. I love that idea too of like, well, it's funny because you can get kind of accused of it when it's not true. It's like, no, I'm not being fake. Like, I'm, like you're saying, I'm putting aside my problems so that I can like respect this situation and respect mm-hmm. you and like give you the like attention and love, like you said, that you deserve. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think that's really cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, you keep those letters and you put them in your drawer for, you know, the tough days and you look at them. And it's funny, for starving artists, you know, we're trying to work our day job, mm-hmm. trying to work late in the night to get our dreams and our passions started. Not that New Bedford is a day job; it's also my vocation. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are moments where you're exhausted, you're tired. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think anyone can relate to that. But I think, where would we be in this world if we could at least, even in our lowest points, still in our hearts hold respect and even a little bit of love for the people around us, even if they don't give it back to you. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really powerful lesson. And I think actually when I listen to classical music, you know, when I listen to Mahler 5, the Adagio movement, that's what I feel. That's what gets me excited, because of it's that underlining love. It's the underlining human connection mm-hmm. that just bubbles up in some of these really great classical works. And maybe someday I'll be good enough, or I'll be great enough to be able to conduct that music. And then how cool will that be? It's really selfish, but it's really fun.
No, I mean, it's not very selfish, though, because you're talking about the interconnectedness. You're talking about community, mm-hmm. you know, talking about something bigger than yourself. Yeah. It's totally not selfish, but I love that, man. It's such an interesting thing, too. It's kind of hard to explain to people that aren't totally wrapped up in classical music, or even people that just aren't really exposed to it. Mm-hmm. But, like, explaining that idea of, like, this music was, like, these guys were hearing God in nature and wanted to get that out there, like, wanted to express that feeling through music.
Yeah.
You know, that's... Really think about what that must have meant in, like, 1500, 1600, 1700s, you know what I mean? That was a whole different ballgame back then. Society was different. The world was different. The way people interacted with the world around them was so different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's so true. I was in Leipzig for a little while a year ago, and I went to Bach's church, and he's buried right there with a rose on top of his grave and looking at his organ. And having some time, you know, and I'll be honest, earlier on in my classical life, you know, Bach was more the guy you studied. A lot of his stuff is very academic. But you start to get to, you know, even his Christmas oratorio or some of his music, and you really start to hear this person just looking up at the universe or this beautiful church that he worked at and thinking, you know, what is it up there? Mm-hmm. You know, asking very human questions, not just, you know, to make a church service that people liked so you get paid, but to really put a question mark and almost a groaning into the universe. It's really cool. I mean, the communication with music, and I know it's like a drum that gets beaten on all the time because that's why we advocate it to be in our schools, but it can't be understated. I mean, I think about when I, you know, whenever I get to hang out with my mom, it's always really great, and my mom and I are very, very close. But what we don't get to do all the time, as much as it did when I was little, is make music together. Mm. But whenever my mom and I play music together, whether I'm playing piano or, you know, way back when I used to play the drums and I had long hair and all that, we can communicate so easily. There's no words. Mm-hmm. I can see how a look that she's doing or a chord, how she plays it. I know exactly which way she's going to go, how she's going to do the phrase. And so I can support her or vice versa. And when you start to communicate with someone on that level, there's nothing really closer to it. It's cool.
Yeah.
You know, and you start to make that connection with other people. It's like an orchestra that you've been able to work with. You know, it's...
I bet.
Well, with Parkway, I'm just conducting their winter concerts, their holiday concerts, one this weekend on Sunday in Walpole. And it's so funny, you know, they didn't know me at the beginning of rehearsals, and you feel that. Mm-hmm. But as we've been going week to week and rehearsing, the shoulders get down a little bit. They start to understand me a little bit, not even with the words that I'm saying, just the gestures that I'm making. And I start to understand them and how they operate. And it's a very deep way of getting to know 50 people.
Like the relationship that you have when you play music with your mom.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's actually really cool.
It's so personal. It's so personal. It's almost scary personal.
Yeah.
Because you also make mistakes.
Yeah, of course.
And when you make that, or what you think of them as a mistake, and it's out there for the world to see. And it's the same for them, though. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of a bassoonist that doesn't get the part.
Yeah.
And you can see, like, oh, or they think they did it terribly. But it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, because when you start to suddenly worry and close your mind in, then you break that communication with the rest of the orchestra.
Right. Yeah, I totally, yeah. You're almost like all, you got to function as one. Got
to
work together.
Try to, right?
Take responsibility together.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
You know, where would Congress be if they all just played in the orchestra together? You know?
Yeah.
Who knows?
So, next question. I thought I'd jump. We're like spending so much time talking about so much awesome stuff.
Oh,
I'm never
going
to get through all these questions. No, no. I'm very happy about that. Okay. This is a great conversation. So I just want to ask, though, what are you working on now? Like, what's on your desk?
Yeah, on my desk. You know, I don't know the famous person that said it, but, you know, they asked, what's your favorite piece? And they said, whatever I'm working on right now.
Oh, nice.
So what I'm working on right now is I'm applying to graduate schools. You know, to get to the next level for me, I need to find a school that will bring me to that next level and will also give me a shot. Mm-hmm. Graduate orchestral conducting programs are very small usually and very limited, but that's my biggest push right now. Other things, I have really great opportunities, whether it's working with Michael in Germany or the Parkway Concert Orchestra, guest conducting them, or I've also been working on the music director of the South Shore Conservatory Youth Orchestra, and we just had a concert. So it's been a really fun musical season. Also, we're now in the season of Advent at Christ Church, which is getting ready for Christmas, which is a lot of organ music, a lot of fun music to prepare. So
your life is 100% music.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, except for, you know, the motor in my Gravely, you know, it's a 1970s built Gravely 812 tractor, and it blew, and there's a whole hole in the side of the engine, and I got to put that motor, fix it before the snow comes.
That'll be fun.
That's how I get it. Yeah. So
awesome.
It's life and music and trying to keep the tractor going.
Yeah. That's so great.
Yeah, that you know, that's what's on my docket, but I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's so great.
It's really exciting. Yeah.
Well, Elijah, this has been an awesome conversation.
Yeah. Thanks, man. I really appreciate you having me come in. Anything.